Good morning, everybody. We have three cases on for this morning, and the first is In Re Community Bank of Northern Virginia, appellate number 17-3012. We're from appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Please, the court. My name is Stanley Stein, and I represent the appellant, and I've requested 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Are we granted?
I wanted to note one thing with regard to the brief of the appellee. On page 7, there's a statement that Mr. Minogue, who was a principal in the Spector law firm, appeared at a conference on August 28, 2017, allegedly representing the plaintiffs. It's cited at 192 and 93A. The date is actually August 28, 2007. So the last time of that the SSEM law firm appeared of record in this case prior to the filing of the motion to the court to take ancillary jurisdiction was 9 years prior to the settlement.
Did either your client's firm or Mr. Carlson ever file the notice with the court or the counsel pursuant to paragraph 13 of the separation agreement concerning the
I don't believe that was ever filed.
Thank you.
And it was up to Mr. Carlson under the paragraph to notify the court and opposing counsel.
Actually, I thought that it had a joint obligation.
There was a joint letter that was supposed to be sent, and apparently was not, I'm advised. But the district court based its decision, basically, to take ancillary jurisdiction on the fact that Spector did not appear in the arbitration and did nothing to provide.
Why should they have appeared?
That's a good question. We don't think they should have, because their claim, which is a referral fee claim in the contract between them and Mr. Carlson, had absolutely no impact on what the arbitration panel was going to do. The arbitration panel had the direction to decide a high-low. So they were to decide between $24 million and $70 million. It would be wrong to suggest that a referral fee paid to my client would have affected or made the arbitration panel pick the $70 million as opposed to the $24 million. So the amount of the award to the plaintiff's class was not affected. The arbitration panel then selected...
it was, because it would have only been a percentage of whatever the high or the low was. So it would have been affected, right?
Well, the fee to class counsel would have been affected, but not my client's referral fee. Whatever Mr. Carlson was to get as a result of the award by the arbitrators, that was going to be determined by the arbitrators in accordance with whatever, and this is the interesting part, whatever private agreement Mr. Carlson had entered into with the other plaintiff's counsel, which the arbitration panel simply accepted. The arbitration panel nor the court.
But the arbitration panel really didn't get involved at all in the agreement between SSEM and Mr. Carlson.
Exactly, because there would have been no reason for them to do so. Carlson could hardly come in to the arbitrators and say, I'm entitled to more money out of this $8.4 million because I have to pay a referral fee to another lawyer. The other members of the class counsel would not have agreed with that, and neither would the arbitrators. You don't. If you've made a deal with another person, that doesn't get to increase the amount that is going to be taken out of the plaintiff's class.
So, well, Mr. Stein, let me ask you this. First of all, you argue here that the district court did not have ancillary jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
Over this referral fee agreement. It's actually not a referral fee. It's a fee that was owed to the old firm.
Right.
It's part of a fee agreement that you argue is outside of the class action settlement. But tell me what the standard is. Tell me what you argue the standard is for us to make that determination as to whether or not there is or is not ancillary jurisdiction.
Well, I think your review is plenary. So whether or not there's ancillary jurisdiction, I think you
I understand that. But how do we determine How do we determine, it's plenary, but how do we determine ancillary jurisdiction or not?
By whether or not the issue before the court is within the terms of either the supplemental jurisdiction statute, which is 1367, which requires that the claims be so related to claims in the action within the original jurisdiction that they form part of the same case or controversy under Article 3 of the Constitution. So for supplemental jurisdiction, the requirement is that they have to be so related to claims in the action. They're not. And for the stay, for a stay of court proceedings, the any injunction staying a state action has to be necessary.
Let me stop you a second there. And you're citing to Section 1367, the supplemental jurisdiction statute. But does the common law doctrine of ancillary jurisdiction survive the survive 1367?
I don't think so. I think 1367 is a longstanding statute that doesn't permit of any wiggle room, so to speak, in interpreting what it means. And when it says so related to claims in the action within the original jurisdiction, I think that's what it means, that you have to look at the facts to see whether there are facts in the underlying case which are also relevant to the case over which you are taking supplemental or ancillary jurisdiction.
Because under the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1994 in Kekkonen versus Guardian, in talking about ancillary jurisdiction, there's a second prong that says that to enable the court to function successfully, that is to manage its proceedings, vindicate its authority, or effectuate its decrees.
Yes, I agree.
If under that section, this would give the court jurisdiction over this question.
I don't believe that any of those issues are involved in this particular case. The court issued its decrees, it issued its orders, its process was complete, and so to just take ancillary jurisdiction over a private contract action between two residents of Pennsylvania accomplishes none of those purposes. That did not in any manner contribute to the jurisdiction and integrity of the court. It did not in any manner affect the administration of the orders that the court entered. Those were all accomplished, the funds were distributed, and the case was over. The case, in fact, was closed as of the date that the judge entered his final settlement approval order, and did not reopen again until something was filed from the arbitration panel in March of 2017. I don't believe that the ancillary jurisdiction as referred to in Kekkonen has anything to do with what happened in this particular case, because to do what the judge did here did not affect any of those considerations.
Because the case was over.
Case was done.
What about the Anti-Injunction Act?
Well, that's the Anti-Injunction Act uses the word where necessary in aid of its jurisdiction or to protect or effectuate its judgments. The Anti-Injunction Act, again, the court has held, the Supreme Court has held, is to be very narrowly construed. And where there is a question, if it's in doubt, then the state court action should be permitted to proceed. And so I don't believe that the action of the district court in taking jurisdiction and issuing an injunction of the state court was in any manner necessary to its jurisdiction.
Did the district court even address it, the Anti-Injunction Act, in its opinion?
Well, I think that in so many words in the district court's opinion, it says that the what he did was necessary to affect its
so by implication,
right.
because of the big history he provided,
right.
In the opinion.
Right.
If we should decide in your favor on ancillary jurisdiction, do we still have to deal with the Anti-Injunction Act because of the fact that there is an outstanding injunction, or would that fade away immediately if we said there is no ancillary jurisdiction?
I think as a matter of procedure, you would have to send the case back and order the district court to lift the injunction, or I think you could lift it yourself.
But we wouldn't have to go through the analysis of the Anti-Injunction Act, you're saying, if there was no jurisdiction to take action.
Yes.
We wouldn't have to go through the anti-injunction analysis. Is that your view? You had a comment in one of your briefs, and it goes to the contract claim itself. I just wanted to ask you why you folks said this. You said that if the contract were interpreted to have a condition precedent that hadn't been satisfied, it would provide, quote, Carlson with a powerful incentive to ensure the original settlement was not affirmed on appeal, close quote. Why do you reach that conclusion?
Because he was about to leave, and we didn't know that February of 2004, and he did leave in April, two months later. So if he avoids having to pay anything out of any fee that he might earn, if he loses the appeal at that time, that settlement is gone. That entry of legal fees, which was $8.1 million at the time, is gone. He takes the case and he continues with the case without now any referral fee obligation. So potentially inures to his financial benefit to take the case without having an obligation to pay a referral fee. And I think that was our thinking in making that statement.
Thank you.
Was if let's assume we held that the district court did have ancillary jurisdiction, and it got to the question then of what, if anything, was owed to your client. Is the fact that there was so much work done on this case post-separation over, 12 years, does that make the fee that your client's claiming under the proportion that they're asking for unreasonable?
No, it's a matter of contract at that point. If the court had ancillary jurisdiction to decide the contract case between the parties, he would be obligated to abide by state law with regard to contracts. So the judge would have to look at the terms of the settlement, the agreement, and decide whether or not the claim meets the contract obligation.
What about the condition precedent?
Well, there was no condition precedent because the district court decided that there was a condition precedent before which Mr. Carlson had to pay money to the law firm. The condition precedent had nothing to do with a Carlson obligation. Carlson had no obligations under that. If the condition precedent is not met, Carlson doesn't get his money. It's Carlson who forfeits the money, not us, not SSEM. Carlson, if the condition is not met, if the settlement is not approved, then Carlson doesn't get what the February 2004 agreement gave him.
But the separation agreement foisted on him all responsibilities concerning the litigation. Well, to accept your principle means he gets no money for all that work.
I don't know whether he gets no money. We don't know what he got based upon the decision of the arbitrators, because the division of money among counsel was kept secret. And that's the risk you take when you take one of these cases anyway. You don't know how they're going to turn out. That's why I think in part you use the percentage of recovery system, because it is a risk. And see, he accepted that risk. We accepted the risk of him being the person working on the case.
Okay, counsel, we're back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Gary Lynch. I represent the appellee, Bruce Carlson, in this matter. I'd like to start off by talking about the ancillary jurisdiction of the district court below. As Judge Fisher mentioned, the Kekkonen case in which Justice Scalia wrote the opinion, in that case, he paraphrased his understanding of the ancillary jurisdiction. I think, Judge Fisher, you quoted the longer section where he mentions there's two prongs to it, but then he ultimately paraphrases it and says ancillary jurisdiction is necessary to control matters which are essential to the conduct of federal court business.
And how could the allocation of fees between two private parties after the court has ruled on the class essential to that court's business as it relates to this class action?
Yes. So the answer to that question lies in Rule 23 and all the precedent that has developed around Rule 23, including precedent from this court in both the GM truck case and the Sendent case, where this court has said that under Rule 23, there's a mandatory obligation by the district court to have close judicial scrutiny of fee arrangements and class action settlements.
Okay, let's talk about that then. As we understand the record in front of us, a fee award was granted. And then before the arbitrators, there was a private agreement among class counsel concerning the allocation of fees. It was not an issue presented to the arbitrators, the district court to decide. Can you now say that this is something a court should be concerned of when the lawyers privately decided to allocate that figure among themselves?
Because we're not talking about looking at what the court actually did in its obligation to have close judicial scrutiny. We're looking at the purview of the court for purposes of determining the parameters of ancillary jurisdiction. So whether the court delegated the ability to apportion the fees among the counsel that were litigating the case at that time, whether that authority was delegated to the counsel themselves, whether it was delegated to the arbitrators, or whether the court wanted to oversee it directly, none of that matters. The point is the oversight that the court has under Rule 23 for all fee claims in a class action is absolute.
But isn't that fee claims against the corpus of the recovery as opposed to fee claims between the attorneys?
It's both. And there's authority to that effect. I think we have it cited in our brief. There's a necessary component that the court has to not only look at the total fee that's going to be paid.
But the court here didn't ask to look at that, did it?
And that doesn't matter, Your Honor. What matters, what we're talking about, is jurisdiction.
The court said, I can approve the settlement. I can approve the amount of the attorney's fees. I don't have to look at the internal makeup of those of the division of those attorney's fees, because fairness to the class, I can look at that. The amount of the attorney's fees would not be affected by the division between the attorneys, the breakup between the attorneys of those fees. So how then is the concern about the attorney's fees something which would in any way affect ancillary jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, my answer to your question is that I disagree with the premise of it. The court absolutely has the ability and the obligation to look, when it chooses to, at the arrangements among counsel.
But it didn't choose to.
They do it all the time. Once again, we're not here to review that. We're trying to determine what is the court's jurisdiction. And I'm saying that there's ancillary jurisdiction on all matters pertaining to fees in a class action, especially an MDL class action, certified under Rule 23.
But in this case, the final order even slashed out anything about fees.
Right, because I think in that court order, the court was delegating it to the arbitration panel.
Right.
But that doesn't mean the court doesn't have the authority or the obligation under Rule 23 to oversee all of this.
Well, you knew, it's ironic in this case. You recognized that Mr. Carlson owed a fee to Spector, because during the course of this case, you yourself actually contacted the representatives of the Spector firm to try to negotiate the fee.
Right. So,
you recognize an obligation. It seems odd to me. And I have trouble getting my arms around this, whether the court has jurisdiction or doesn't have jurisdiction. It seems odd to me that you recognize there's a fee, and I'm saying you plural, not you
right.
Individually. But you argue before Judge Schwab they're not entitled to a fee because of the condition precedent. It's just contradictory.
No, there was never any contradiction on our part. mine personally or the firm.
I understand.
There's no fee owed because the condition precedent was never met.
Let me take you back a step. Before there was a fee agreement from February, or before there was a separation agreement from June, Mr. Carlson had an agreement with the firm that he would get a salary, he would get some benefits, and he'd get a percentage of cases he brought in. How do you ignore that agreement?
Nobody's ignoring anything. We're here to say that the district court has the ultimate purview of all these issues under Rule 23.
Well, then even if the district court had jurisdiction, how can you defend a decision that says that doesn't matter?
Well, if you look at the agreement, and that's our argument.
I'm talking about the initial agreement.
Yes.
You agree with Mr. Carlson when he joined the Spector firm, got a salary, and he got a percentage of a fee, of future fees of cases he brought in. How do you ignore that agreement?
We're not ignoring that agreement. We're looking at the literal terms of that agreement, and that agreement set forth essentially two categories of cases, cases that were resolved and cases that had to be litigated.
Now, I think you're going to the separation agreement. You jumped to the separation agreement. I'm talking about the initial agreement in 2001.
Well, the initial agreement also, as it relates to this fee, was premised upon as a condition precedent that the case was settled and it was on appeal and the appeal would be affirmed. That didn't happen. Yeah, once that reversal occurred...
I'm not sure you're answering my question because you're jumping all the way to the June 2004 agreement, and I'm not talking about that.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question anymore.
I'm talking about the fact that when Carlson joined the firm in 2001, right?
Yes.
He got a salary and they agreed to pay him a percentage of anything he brought in. This is a case that falls within that agreement, as I see it. He was entitled to a percentage of anything I didn't. The converse of that means they were entitled to the other percentage on that particular case.
Right, but none of this is static. Everything is fluid with this these litigations.
Everything is what?
None of this is static, though. Things
change.
Are you
trying to say that the June, the February order, whatever the first 2004 agreement was, superseded the agreement that Judge Fisher is speaking of?
No, I think it's read in conjunction. It's the same agreement. We understand completely that as an employee of Spector,
right,
he received benefits, and that those were ultimately analyzed and dealt with,
okay,
between these two agreements that occurred in February and June of that year. The bottom line is there were about four or five complaints filed in this case,
right,
and then a settlement occurred. That's all that ever happened. It was settled. It was objected to. This court vacated that settlement. And ultimately, this turned into a 14-year piece of litigation that I spent a good chunk of my personal career litigating. And there are several other attorneys that spent time litigating. The idea, just on a pure fairness ability.
And you may very well have, because in that same document I referred to, that email, you may very well have a claim against your partner, Mr. Carlson, for excess work that you put in, which may in the fees divvied up different, but that's your problem. But the question I have here, I just don't see how the district court can leave this case if they have jurisdiction and say Spector is not entitled to anything.
Well, are we accepting the premise that the district court is the one that has to answer that question?
I said assuming they do. Assuming they do, I can't see how you can walk out of there and defend a position where the district court says Spector isn't entitled to a fee.
So the district court's analysis is that the contract is valid, but if the literal terms of the contract applying to this situation would mean that there was no fee interest by the Spector firm after the vacated settlement in 2005, simply because those agreements contemplate a whole category of cases that Mr. Carlson was performing work on, that the Spector firm retained no fee interest in whatsoever because all the litigation was out in front in those cases. That's what this case became. Now, for the settled cases, they had fee splits worked out. This was one of the cases that they expected it to be settled, and the settlement would be affirmed on appeal to this court. That turned out not to be the case.
The amount of money that was awarded in this case, $24 million went to the settlement administrator. Where's the rest of it? Did it all get has it been distributed, including the fee to counsel? Has it all been distributed?
I think it was $8.4 million, and it's all been distributed.
Okay, so the court has no control over these monies, correct?
I'm not sure I understand the parameters of that question.
Not holding any money. Has no control.
No, there's no money in escrow anywhere or anything like that.
So it has no control over any of the money. The money has been dispersed to private counsel.
Right. When was this dispersed?
Last year, I think.
Was it after the district court's order, which is on appeal before us?
No.
It was dispersed
before that, I believe. Yes.
Okay, so all the more reason, how does the court have jurisdiction over a fund that's no longer part of the case?
Because everything the court could have and should have done back when the fee approval process was undergoing, as part of the settlement approval process under Rule 23, it can do now. It's the same thing. You can't circumvent Rule 23 scrutiny that this court has insisted upon in district courts.
Even if we should believe that, what about the Anti-Injunction Act?
Well, once you accept, of course, the ancillary jurisdiction, affect the Anti-Injunction Act question.
How does it need the Anti-Injunction Act to preserve its jurisdiction? Mm-hmm. Because everything's been distributed.
Everything's been distributed, but the court still has the purview of deciding these issues with regard to fee disagreements.
But they're all done.
What's that?
They're all done.
Well, we're all done except for...
The attorney's fees are all done.
We're all done except for the Specter firm claims of fee interest.
The part that the court needed to approve on the fees has been done. The court has no further role to play, no further authority to determine what those fees are going to be between the attorneys.
So what you're saying, Your Honor, would lead... If that's the conclusion this court's going to go to, that would mean that in every case where there's a fee agreement among counsel... In a class action, the parties have the ability to take the purview that I'm talking about, which has been insisted on by this court on numerous occasions, and across the country and other appellate courts, under Rule 23. We can circumvent that among ourselves by agreeing to just hold back and have private agreements and don't let the court get involved with it.
Well, that's exactly what happened here, though, because as I understand it, there was supposed to have been notice provided to the court and all counsel concerning the allocation agreement that was reached between Mr. Carlson and his former law firm. That was never given. Then when counsel gets in front of the arbitrator, they tell the arbitrator, according to the arbitrator's opinion, we have a private agreement. You don't need to see it. We're gonna divide it all up. So in two instances here, there was a desire not to have the court play a role in allocation of the attorney's fees. How do you get around that?
So the only desire not to have the district court be involved in this issue is by the Specter firm.
What about the, but Mr.
They
Carlson
sat for 14 years and stayed in hiding.
Excuse me, counsel. Mr. Carlson did not submit a letter consistent with the agreement, the paragraph 13 separation agreement provision that said give notice to court and counsel about this agreement. They didn't do that either, did they?
I don't think that was ever done. But I think after this court vacated the first settlement in 2005, it was our position under the contract terms. This case now became a different case. It became a case under the other category of cases.
But that provision
still needed to be litigated.
That provision, paragraph 13, wasn't unique to this case, was it?
No.
It went to all the other cases that were referenced too, correct?
Yes.
So that provision still persisted to live on, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk back to, I'd like to follow up on what Judge Roth was asking about the Anti-Injunction Act. The Anti-Injunction Act, you can only get around it by three exceptions. One is whether the federal statutes at issue communicate to the world this is uniquely a federal matter. We don't really have that here. I'm aware that the causes of action have fee shifting, but none of them say these are unique federal interests. The next one is necessary in aid of jurisdiction. At the time that this lawsuit was filed and then brought before the district court, all of its work had been done. The orders had been entered and the money had been dispersed. So there was nothing that would interfere with the court's ability to fulfill its obligations concerning the case. Isn't that correct?
That is not correct, Your Honor.
Are you going to go back to tell me because the court is an ongoing fiduciary of the class? Its obligations persist. Is that your answer?
It's partly my answer, but my stronger answer is that the parties can't circumvent that fiduciary obligation by playing around with the timing of when things happen. You keep referring to the case as being done. The case is not done if there's somebody out there that has a claim for fees who purposely hid from the court's analysis of the fee issue until the court ultimately resolved the case.
The claim for fees is contained within the overall amount that the court awarded for attorney's fees. They're not going to go back in court and say, open this all up, I didn't get my fee, you have to make a larger award. The claim for fees was from the determined pot that the court had approved.
Right, it is that approval process that the court retains jurisdiction over and cannot, you cannot circumvent that approval process.
But what does it retain jurisdiction over? Because it's decided all it needs to decide.
If there was an issue that was withheld from it, and our argument is that there was by the Spector firm.
But that issue had no influence on the overall attorney's fee awarded.
Absolutely it did. If a district court would hear that there's a $3 million, as an example, I'm picking numbers out of the air, there's a $3 million fee claim, and they say, well, let's see the lodestar of all the counsel that worked on it. Well, Your Honor, here's the way it is. We're getting $500,000, and a firm is getting $2.5 million under an agreement that they don't have to do any work at all for the class. They're just going to get $2.5 million for. A district court, on behalf of the class, would look askance at that agreement and potentially have the ability to set it aside.
Look askance at it because they say, why the hell didn't you present it to us when you were asking for attorney fee approval in the first place?
It was up to the Spector firm to raise that issue. It's their fee claim. Our position under that agreement was that looking at the literal terms of it.
Okay, I think yeah. We've reached an impasse. Yeah, so.
Let me ask you this more global question. Doesn't the interpretation you're asking for have a significant impact on the practice of law that you're involved with? I mean, it seems to me, if you look at this record here and some of the other cases, that there are referral agreements all over the lot among plaintiff's attorneys for a piece of this, a piece of that, and they're memorialized in paper. And whenever the fee's allotted, you go back and you divvy up the proceeds among people who may have been helping you in that initial instance. I mean, isn't what you're asking for going to bring all these cases into district court and say that the district court in the future is going to have to resolve all of those kind of contingent agreements by early originators of cases?
The district court always gets involved in all of those issues you just described, Your Honor. And it does so by one of two ways, either asking the parties to declare all of them, make them all public, make them all known to the court, and the court can opine on each one of them, or by delegating to lead counsel that it appoints the ability to decide those delegation interests
right.
in this allocation.
Exactly.
So that wasn't done here.
That delegation doesn't include a specific itemization of every single deal that somebody out there may have had.
It may or may not. That's up to the court.
It may or may not.
Yeah.
But what my point on a global question is, isn't that going to end up by you saying, in order for you to get ancillary jurisdiction here, you're arguing that a district court in a class action like this has jurisdiction over all of these kind of deals?
Absolutely, that's what I'm
okay.
saying.
All right, if that's what you're arguing.
And I think Rule 23 and the president of this court supports that.
Huh?
I think the president of this court supports that argument.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
A few quick points. Fee arrangements in the class actions that were cited to this court in every case deals with a decision by the court to either allocate the damage award to the class or the legal fees for doing the work on the case. That's what Rule 23 deals with. That's what all of the cases deal with. There's not a single case that's been cited by either side that doesn't involve the decision by the court over one of those two issues. So it's not a referral fee that the district court has the obligation to review separately with a third party. It's whether or not the original fee allocation to the attorneys is proper under Rule 23 for the work that was done on the case.
And that's the class.
Yes, in the class action or in the statutory fund case as well. So the Rule 23 does not require the district judge to review whether or not a private agreement between Mr. Carlson and SEM had anything to do with the class action. When private agreements have been disregarded by the courts in all of these cases, where it has been disregarded, it is for the court to enable it to determine whether the money going to the class is fair and whether or not the money going to the attorneys for the work on that case adequately compensates them. All of the fees over the 14 years of work were taken into account in the arbitration proceeding because the arbitrators presumably used the Lodestar method to check whether or not the percentage fee that it ordered, the 35%, was fair, and that's what they did. So Mr. Carlson got the credit or the benefit of whatever number of hours, the 6,000 or so hours, was spent. They attributed 61,000 hours to all of the class counsel for a total Lodestar of 31 million. So all of that work was taken into account. And I resent this, that the SSEM firm stayed in hiding. We did not stay in hiding. We did not receive notice of the arbitration proceedings. There's nothing on the docket. Carlson doesn't say he gave us notice. We didn't have any opportunity to come before the arbitrators to tell the arbitrators about this. Carlson was there. He was the one who had the obligation to tell the arbitrators, not us. We were not in hiding. He was in hiding. He was before the arbitrators. He had the opportunity to tell the arbitrators if this fee should have in any way impacted the decision of the arbitrators with regard to a fee. He got credit for the fair fee that supposedly was generated from his work on the case. So basically, what we would have would be decisions by a district court which evaluated the work of the lawyers on the case. The district court would come to a decision with regard to what was fair consideration, compensation for those counsel for work on the case, and then counsel would then basically throw a Hail Mary to the district court and say, look, I entered into a bad agreement with an attorney on a referral fee. Get me out of it. That's what will happen if a decision like this where the court is entitled to review a private referral or any other kind of contract between class counsel and somebody not involved in the case happens. I was awarded what was a fair fee. If I have to pay this referral fee, now my fee is not fair anymore. Help me.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both sides for a well-briefed and well-argued case. We'll take the matter under advisement.